Once upon a time, different generations of Americans lived under the same roofs. It was a time in our history when a lot of the population lived on farms and kids grew up to inherit the land while their parents grew old in the house. We don't live like that anymore. So opportunities for people of different generations to share knowledge and just plain experiences are limited. Too bad, because we got a lot of older people in the country now. Baby boomers retire at the rate of about 10,000 people a day. And they've got lots of knowledge they could pass on. Mark Friedman writes about how in the book, How to Live Forever, The Enduring Power of Connecting the Generations. Mark Friedman has been tracking, writing about, and speaking on the longevity revolution for years now. He's the founder and CEO of Encore.org, which is about using the skills and talents of people over 50. Mark is a frequent media guest and the author of four previous books. Mark Friedman, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff. I really appreciate the chance to be on the show today.
It's good to have you. It's an important subject. And you start with such a heartwarming story. Tell us about Gil Stott and your encountering him in college.
Well, you know, I've been working on these issues for such a long time and always talking about the demographics and these broad societal trends. And when I sat down to write the book, I realized that I'd been living out the argument that I was making in the book, that older people have an enormously powerful role to play in the lives of younger people. I went off to college in 1976 ill-prepared for higher education, and I think in my first 2 years I probably set an intercollegiate record for incomplete classes. I had 9 before I had finished 4 semesters. And
Wow. It
turns out that in order to get granted an incomplete, you had to go visit the associate provost, who was a wizened 60-something named Gil Stott, who happily granted me the incompletes. But mostly he took me under wing, and I almost felt like part of his extended family. And I think if not for Gil Stott's role in my life, I don't think I would have graduated from college. And so I think that left a really indelible appreciation of the role older people could play. And particularly, Gil never gave me advice. He gave me acceptance. And I think all too often we confuse mentoring with, imparting the strategic plan to a younger person and how they could turn their life around. But really what Gil did, and I think what the successful mentors I've met over the years is really that appreciation and acceptance.
That's really interesting. So it's not necessarily this sort of active guiding toward an ultimate set of goals or a plan so much as it is just letting the person have the time to marinate.
It's so true. You know, Uri Bronfenbrenner, who was one of the founders of the Head Start program and a giant of child development in as an academic discipline. He taught at Cornell for decades. And at the end of his career, when asked to distill what he'd learned from all these years of, heady academic studies, he said, "What every child needs is at least one adult who's irrationally crazy about them." And I think, with Gil Stott, it was more the irrational than the rational. Sure, I'm sure he could have given me lots of wise advice, but he mostly, he mostly gave me, what could be said to be love.
Yeah, and room to grow, it sounds like. And so it's a great, great story of mentorship, which you hope can be replicated by other people. You give the mismatch in numbers between old and young in the United States today. As of 2016, we had 110 million people over 50 and 74 million under 18. So you see an opportunity here. Would you lay it out for us?
Sure. In fact, since I finished the book, I actually dove into the numbers more fully, and to my shock and amazement, I realized that in about, 5 weeks, and as 2019 starts, that will be the first year in American history where we've had more people over 60 than under 18. It's really the Rubicon, and we're wading into it right now, and we'll cross it in 2019. And this whole idea of being a society of more older people than younger people is a shock to the American system. We split off from Europe and the old world. We thought of ourselves as about youth, vigor, newness, and that was a big part of the American identity for most of our history. But it's just not true anymore. We are, and it's probably one of the reasons why there's so much concern and hand-wringing and consternation about this new demographic makeup, you know, that it's going to be a source of conflict, of kids versus Keynes, as this gray wave of greedy geezers bankrupts posterity. And, you know, there is definitely reason to be concerned about how we navigate this. It's such an enormous trend. But I'm convinced, maybe going back to my Gil Stott experience, but even more looking at the research, that this is as much an opportunity to be seized as a problem to be solved.
Well, and you do talk about people who mention the kids versus Keynes generational war. I'm going to send a generational war in quotes, but you also talk about social scientists and what they say about generational interdependence and its value to us just as a species.
Absolutely. You know, if you shift the lens from fiscal wrangling to emotional truths, what turns out to be you know, deeply etched in human nature is a bond between older and younger people. It really goes back to the beginnings of human history. And when we were evolving from primates, now anthropologists believe it was the role of grandmothers who took care of babies while mothers and fathers were able to go off and continue foraging that enabled the long gestational period that separates humans from all other species. Our babies are helpless for a much longer period of time. So in some ways, the role of older people historically, going back in this evolutionary sense, is what makes us human. But if you shift to human development, those truths are brought very much to the fore.
Much more to talk about with Mark Friedman. His book is How to Live Forever, The Enduring Power of Connecting the Generations. So no, it's not about physically living forever, but the book does talk about some people who would like to see that happen too. We'll see where those things come together and then peel off again. Mark Friedman on the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails. Back on the Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Mark Friedman, who is the founder and CEO of Encore.org, about using the skills and talents of people over 50, and that's what his book is about. We're entering a period in American history where there are more people over the age of 60 than there are people under the age of 18. He talks about combining generations for the good of all. His book is called How to Live Forever, The Enduring Power of Connecting the Generations. You can join the conversation on the Exchange with your thoughts, questions, comments, 800-838-3760 over the phone. Send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Mark, we talked about Gil Stott up front, a heartwarming story from your college years as somebody who took you under his wing and just sort of let you develop. There's another story in here from our corner of the world, Cherry Hendricks from the Portland area. Tell us about her.
Well, Cherry Hendricks was probably just as influential in my own life and my work as Gil Stott was. I first met Cherry a quarter century ago when she was a foster grandparent in Portland. It's a program that was created during the War on Poverty in 1965 that pairs low-income older people together with children who are in need, who are living in poverty, usually one-on-one. And Cherry had done that for a decade, and she had actually come to Portland originally as part of the migration of African Americans to work in the ports during World War II. She was essentially a Rosie the Riveter story. And it turns out she was a distant relative of Jimi Hendrix as well.
Oh, wow.
So she had a great personal history. And she had decided that she wanted to do more with these young people and was an avid bowler. And she created a bowling league in Portland for these kids and handwrote 43 permission slips to the parents of these children and convinced Interstate Lanes in Portland to give them free lanes and essentially started an after-school program for kids built around her passion. And I was so taken with Cherry that when I was working with others to create something called Experience Corps, which is essentially like a Peace Corps for older people focused on helping the next generation thrive, Cherry was essentially the first member and the prototype for that program. And she continued to work in Experience Corps until she was nearly 100. So she had a 40-year stretch from the time she retired from her midlife work until she stopped her encore career and was an inspiration for so many people along the way.
So the so-called second act can be a rather lengthy act for some people, for sure.
It's true. I mean, in many ways, not everybody lives to 100 like Charlie, although it turns out that half the children born in the developed world since 2000 are projected to see their 100th birthday. But you can see how this period that used to be the leftover years can now be as long as midlife in duration and in many ways be just as significant. I think when Cherry looked back on her life and all the things that she had accomplished, this later chapter that was focused on service to the next generation was probably the most meaningful for her.
I am impressed as I read the book, How to Live Forever, that some of the things that we think about age groups. I mean, we know there are certain biases that we have, you know, the way that the baby boomers knock the millennials and sometimes the millennials knock the baby boomers and so forth. But these are really societal constructs. And you really get into this by writing about the creation of adolescence 100 years ago. What is that? We didn't have adolescence before 100 years ago?
Well, Jeffrey, I'm so glad you asked that question because it turns out that my entire realization about that idea began in Medford.
Really?
I had turned 50, and as part of the celebration, I was driving with my family, two kids and my wife, to Portland, and we decided to stop at the Homewood Suites in Medford, and I simultaneously got the senior discount for being over 50 and had to call back and request two cribs in the room.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
It gave me an insight into this awkward period that I think is emerging between the middle years and anything resembling old age. And, you know, oftentimes it's an oxymoronic period. You're the young old or the working retired, all these terms that are jammed together. But I think what we are seeing, like you were saying, is as we've lengthened the duration of life, we're rewriting the map of life. And the same thing happened at the beginning of the last century. We had children and adults, but all of a sudden there was a population explosion of young people who weren't either one. And we created adolescence and developed child labor laws and developed new educational institutions, eventually coined the word teenager. And I think the same thing is happening now as this population explosion of people moving into their late 50s, 60s, 70s is happening. And people have described this period as a season in search of a purpose. And I think that's really true. And in many ways, that was the origin of this book, is asking that question about what is the purpose of this season, especially as so many people are flooding into it.
Well, so essentially we're left with the same sort of issue we were left with around the age of 20, which is like, what do we want to do with our lives?
Exactly. And, you know, again, to go back to the Cherry Hendricks example, there's time to do something really significant. You know, you can take a break for a while and rest up and still have a significant new chapter. The problem is that in the way society is set up now, it's a do-it-yourself process. You know, young people, when they hit their 20s, there are higher education institutions and internships and all of these structures to help people transition from one period to another. And we've been slow to develop the cultural norms, the structures to help people navigate this period.
Which is kind of weird when you think about it, because we've known for 60 years we were going to have a bunch of old people.
Well, I think part of it is that our conception of this period is so out of date. You know, there's an economist at Stanford, a guy named John Chauvin, who points out that 65 became the definition of old age in 1935 with the creation of Social Security, which, you know, one of the great triumphs in American public policy. But the, you know, Chauvin points out, you know, we'd never use $1935 dollars in 2018 without adjusting them for inflation, but we use this definition of being over the hill as if it was some eternal verity, and it's not. And so this whole, you know, we tend to, you know, you hit that period, you get your senior discount, you're characterized as being, you know, past your prime, when in fact, for so many people, they're entering, I think, a remarkable period that's one of the sweet spots in life where you become more aware of your mortality, which gives you a sense of what really matters in life. There's a lot of psychological research around that. And you actually have the time to do something with it. And so I think that there's a great opportunity for society, but also for us as individuals entering this period.
Mark Friedman is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called How to Live Forever, The Enduring Power of Connecting the Generations. You can join us as we talk about ways in which people can connect across age boundaries and find ways to be useful to each other and to help society advance. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I promised our listeners we'd talk about the people who do want to physically live forever. You say cheating death is cheating life. How do you figure that?
Well, you know, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area where a lot of people are spending a lot of money to live a lot longer. Google has a collaboration with the drug company AbbVie called that Calico, and its aim is to dramatically expand the length of life, and many of the titans of Silicon Valley, Larry Ellison of Oracle fame included, Peter Thiel, have been very open about their desire to eliminate death. And I guess if you had billions of dollars, you'd want to be around for a while. But, as Michael Kinsley, the writer, points out, it doesn't so much matter what Larry Ellison thinks about death so much as what death thinks about Larry Ellison. And I do think that they're missing the point. You know, and it's a point that JFK himself made actually in the year in which he died. He got up in front of Congress and gave his most important speech on aging and said we'd added years to life. Now it was time to add life to those years. And since that period, we'd have added an average of 2 months a year to the American lifespan. So we're doing great on the adding months and years to life part. But how well are we doing in turning those years into a meaningful time that people can genuinely look forward to? And I think in many ways the key to that is around embracing our mortality and recognizing that we're a species that's not designed to live on literally, but rather from generation to generation.
I was fascinated by your mentioning in the book of people voting for scenarios on how long to live and how well. And people didn't tend to opt for the living to 100 kind of thing. What did they prefer?
I think most people in the surveys that I've seen would like to live healthy into their 80s and then, you know, just drop dead in their sleep and have a full life. There are really very few people who want to live to 120 or 150. And I think it's ironic, but Steve Jobs actually was one of the most eloquent and thoughtful observers about this, and he gave a wonderful commencement speech at Stanford, and in which he said that getting up in the morning and looking in the mirror and realizing that could be his last day was what that existential reality was what gave meaning to his life, and it reminded him to do the things that matter most. And it turns out that in psychological studies, if you tell people that they have a fixed amount of time to live, if you've got a month left to live, you know, you don't go out and study Mandarin or, you know, learn how to play the vibraphone. What you do is focus on the people you love and on relationships. And I think that's one of the most important parts of this period of life and coming to be, you know, Atul Gawande wrote this beautiful book, Being Mortal, about accepting death a few years ago. But I think that there's an opportunity to live mortal, to recognize our mortality before the very end, and to act on that truth. And I think in doing that, it turns out it's the secret to human happiness and focusing on relationships and relationships that flow down the generational chain. George Vaillant, who ran the most important study of adult development, the Harvard study of adult development for 40 years, found that older people who connected with younger people were three times as likely to be happy as those who failed to do so.
All right, so connecting across the generations, obviously the theme of the whole book, How to Live Forever, and the focus of what we're talking about here. But when we talk about social connections and their value to us as we get older, there's a part in the book where you really got my attention. Laura Carstensen, I think at Stanford, did the research showing that the happiest people in assisted living were the ones with the fewest social connections?
And it was a paradox that at first she didn't understand, and that's where her theory, which has a kind of complex title, socio-emotional selectivity, emerged. But it was that people at this stage of life realized that relationships were most important, but then decided to focus on those relationships that mattered most, and they prune their social networks. And so, you know, the aunt who was, you know, boring them and driving them crazy for decades, their calls didn't get returned. They zeroed in on the people who were most important, who they cared the most about. And so that paradox, you know, turned out to be one of agency, in which people were recognizing that, you know, there wasn't an endless period of time and they needed to focus on the people who they cared most about.
Interesting. So it's a real quality versus quantity kind of observation.
It's true. And then that same Harvard study that I mentioned, the Harvard study of adult development, it's sort of the gold standard of happiness in later life, has found something very very similar. Valent has said happiness is love, full stop. That's basically what they've learned from the study, and particularly this kind of love that flows from generation to generation.
All right. So obviously, quality relationships, they don't have to be great in number, and across generations really help. So, but now here's what I ask carefully. We're talking about certainly making people later in life feel needed and important and imparting of their knowledge. How do you introduce them to younger people who, in a lot of cases, really don't want a whole lot to do with old people? At least it seems that way at first.
Well, I think you raised two really important points. I mean, one is that we've screwed this up mightily. when we talked before about what young people need, adults who care about them, it turns out that the most significant longitudinal studies of children who make it against the odds all show that caring adults are the critical ingredients, including particularly older people. The studies of happiness in adulthood show that these kinds of connections with younger generations are critical, essentially like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that fit together, but that's not happening. And we're hearing about the ageism and loneliness with older people and younger people being the two loneliest groups in society. So, you know, how come something so natural is not normal in our daily life? And it's because we screwed things up mightily. We went from the beginning of the last century, in 1900, we were the most age-integrated society in the world. And by the time we crossed into the 21st century, we're the most age-segregated. And in the space of 100 years, we managed to reshuffle society in a way that was organized around chronological age. Many, many, you know, ways for reasons that made perfect sense, universal schooling, child labor laws. But the end result is a society in which this very natural and important connection between older and younger people requires almost heroic measures to bridge. And so I think that's something that we need to turn around.
Well, you mentioned longitudinal research, and in fact, Amy Werner is the one who really broke a lot of ground here with her research on people on Kauai in Hawaii, and really followed these people for a long time. What kinds of help did the older people give to the younger people, and what were the results?
It really came down to these caring, sustained relationships, and Emmy's study that you mentioned, she first of all, remarkable 40-year study on the Hawaiian island of Kauai. So I figured any scholar who can figure out how to go to Kauai for 40 years. But it turns out that the children growing, she studied the entire birth cohort of children born in, I believe it was 1956 on Kauai. They're mostly from families working on sugar plantations, tremendous grinding poverty, high levels of alcohol abuse, really actually very difficult circumstances. And she predicted that despite that, some kids would make it anyway. And she termed them resilient children. And at that time, most scholars of kids who were growing up in poverty were looking at juvenile delinquents, the term of the day, you know, and what they had in common. But Emmy decided to focus on the kids who made it despite the odds and to see what they had in common. And it turns out that above all else was a caring adult in the community who had taken them under wing. And it raised an important question. If that's what resilient kids need, how can we provide that to a wider swath of young people?
And there are examples that we've talked about already, foster grandparents and experience corps, and we have more to talk about with Mark Friedman as we continue to venture into his book, How to Live Forever, The Enduring Power of Connecting the Generations. As we head to the break, I want to remind you today is Giving Tuesday. JPR is taking part. So if JPR makes your life better and is someplace you'd consider parking some money before the end of the year on this Giving Tuesday, please give us a call at 888-552-6191. Sounds like fun drive, doesn't it? 888-552-6191 or ijpr.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're entering a period in history when there are more Americans over the age of 60 than there are Americans under the age of 18. 10,000 baby boomers retire every day at the moment. That'll continue for a few more years while we still have baby boomers in the workforce. How do they impart their talents to people who can make use of them? How do we get intergenerational participation in society? That's the questions answered in Mark Friedman's book, How to Live Forever, The Enduring Power of Connecting the Generations. You can join the conversation with Mark here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned how age-segregated we are. We're one of the most age-segregated societies in America. And in fact, there's a whole chapter in the book called Age Apartheid about the likes of Sun City and Del Webb. I mean, how far and wide has it grown? I mean, how many people live in places where kids just aren't allowed?
It's particularly stark in places like you said, Sun City. And I think, you know, those places, Sun City was the first large-scale retirement community in America built around the idea of recapturing your youth. Graying is playing. And when it opened on January 1st, 1960, 100,000 people showed up. There was a traffic jam for 12 miles trying to get in. And it fused this idea of later life as a second youth. Del Webb coined the phrase the golden years. And it married it to the idea of age segregation. A lot of people have argued that's because people at communities like Sun City don't want to pay school taxes, and that's true. But it's also because the presence of actual children disrupts the idea that, you know, you're a kid again. And so I think, you know, if everybody's old, nobody's old. But it's really spread that golden years ideal pretty widely. And so people are making housing choices, community choices that tend to be just with people their own age. And that really goes against the grain of human development, what we need. And it's probably no surprise in that context that there is so much ageism, because age segregation, I think, is the soil in which these stereotypes are rooted, and we see potential conflict, but most of all, loneliness. That I think there's been a much greater appreciation in recent years about the consequences of loneliness. Vivek Murthy, the Surgeon General under Obama, wrote an article in Harvard Business Review last year and argued that loneliness was the single greatest public health epidemic in America today, equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And the two groups that are most socially isolated are young people and older adults. And so I think there's both a whole set of problems that have resulted from this kind of segregation, but also a real opportunity to solve those problems through bringing people together in daily life.
Let's get an example from one of our listeners. Here's a call from Vince in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Mark Friedman, who wrote How to Live Forever.
Hello there.
Hi.
Yes, I'm 67. I'm a retiree with a background in school counseling. And I started about a year ago volunteering as a mentor at my local middle school. And I found it a really worthwhile program. You spend about an hour around the child's lunchtime discussing things while you're eating lunch together in the library or in a conference room, and give the child an opportunity to talk. And I found out both the young men I've been mentoring, they have no grandparents nearby. One child's grandparents live in the New Mexico state area, and another child's, half the parents are from Southern California, and the other half of his grandparents are from Mexico. So he seems to really, the last child especially that I've been working with this semester, appreciate the time to talk to somebody, and his questions are wonderful, and you can tell he just has no familial, you know, opportunities to talk to somebody of my generation, you know, when I could talk to him about 50s rock and roll and World War II history and those kinds of things. It's a really worthwhile program. It's one of the best things I've done. I mean, you could just spend so much time in your retirement traveling and going shopping in different towns and wine tours and those kinds of things. So I'd like to put a pitch in there for any seniors, especially senior men. They seem to get, in these school volunteer programs, a lot of female college students that want to get some volunteer credit on their resume, I guess, and very few males. And I've been making pitches to friends who are retired, male friends who are retired, to go check out with their local school district, you know, what they can do in their retirement. And the other part, since I heard some more of the radio, is last February I went to visit my college roommate who bought a home, a condo in southern Florida in a town not far from Fort Lauderdale. I won't mention it. And I was just aghast at the fact that he lives in a development of over 200 homes, and we never saw any of his neighbors, except he would say sometimes a little old lady would come out and walk a dog. Mm-hmm. And they all stay in their homes, and whatever they're doing in there, I have no idea. Mm-hmm. And then I found out my brother was buying a senior villa in a village, they call it, in a town which will remain anonymous, just north of Tampa, of over 3,000 homes of seniors. Mm-hmm. And they all have three golf courses and a country club and a lodge and a theater, and they never leave these villages. Mm-hmm. Except to go grocery shopping. Mm-hmm. And get their medications or a doctor's appointment.
All right, Vince, thanks for sharing the stories.
My brother, that he was moving into a place that I would consider a senior ghetto, you know.
Right.
I was just astounded that both my friend and my brother thought this was the way to spend their senior lives, to isolate themselves.
All right.
And I just was wondering, you know, what you thought of that.
All right, Vince, thank you so much.
Well, there's so much that Vince brings up, and I think just on his last point, is this is something we created over the last 50 years. It's not something natural. In fact, it runs deeply against the grain of what will make us happy, this kind of radical age segregation. In fact, the very first community of this type, called Youngtown, built around this ideal of a second youth, was in the news a couple of decades ago because they were ejecting a couple for harboring their own grandson. Their grandson had been a victim of abuse, had no place else to turn, and he went to stay with his parents in Youngtown, which prohibited children from living there. And the community planted a sign on the lawn, was like the scarlet letter, harboring children, and fined the couple $100 a day until they got rid of their own grandson. The New York Times was writing about this story and pointed out that dogs were allowed at Youngtown, but not children. And I think, you know, that's a tragic situation. We essentially rerouted the river of life, what we need, what makes us happy, and we need to return it to its natural course. And what Vince is doing is a powerful example to find essentially new ways to do old things. It's true, you know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, that would happen naturally on the farmstead. But it doesn't happen in our modern world where grandparents and grandchildren often don't live anywhere near each other. So how can we be as creative around bringing people together as we were in splitting them apart? And I think that's going to be really one of the big challenges of the more old than young society.
And so then how delicate is the balance there, Mark? I mean, giving meaningful experiences to people both young and old without either group feeling like someone's been foisted upon them.
You know, it's interesting. I think that you raise such an important question, because I think the foisting is not going to work. It has to be natural. And I, you know, I think of this is obviously a small example, but I think makes the larger point. I went to a wonderful place in Cleveland called Judson Manor. In fact, when I showed up at Judson Manor in November of last year, I was greeted by a contingent of Swedish social scientists who were coming to Cleveland in November to find new ideas for creating a better society. And they were at Judson because the community had created a program, an artist-in-residence program for the nearby Cleveland Institute of Music for graduate music students to live rent-free among the older people in Judson Manor. And the idea was they'd enrich the culture of the place. But the residents in Judson Manor loved music and the arts, and they were living next door to young people who had the same passion, and it was around that passion for the arts that these relationships formed. And I remember one of the most moving stories, this young violist from the Cleveland Institute of Music married another violist, and she had her 90-year-old neighbor be the maid of honor at the wedding. And it was because they were neighbors, and they loved music, and they had formed a real relationship. So I think it's really important to create settings where people of different generations, of different ages, can connect around mutual interest.
Do you find that there are some sectors of society or the economy that would rather be apart? I mean, we hear about the tech people in San Francisco, unfairly or not, you know, labeled as like, you know, they're just kind of among themselves.
It's true. And, you know, we already had the example Vince was talking about of the housing industry, which has for so long profited through creating age-segregated communities, which, by the way, were the prototype for gated communities more broadly, which is, it just shows the kind of influence this can have. But now there's a counter-movement that's happening in housing. It's not just among innovative architects and visionaries, but among some of the biggest housing developers in the country, which are creating granny flats and three-gen arrangements. And one of the most dramatic examples, though, at a society-wide level of turning this around is in Singapore, where that country of 4 million people is spending $3 billion to become the envy of aging societies around the world. And the centerpiece is through connecting the generations. They say they want to create a kampong for all ages, kampong being the Malay word for village.
I noticed that you visited St. Joseph's in Singapore, which it sounds like unlike any place in the United States.
It's true. You know, although, you know, since coming back from Singapore, what I loved about Singapore is how comprehensive these efforts were. Every new senior center and preschool are being co-located. They're creating three-gen flats where three generations can live together. But, you know, I've been struck how many, there are over 100 similar arrangements now in the United States where senior centers and preschools are being brought together. In Gorham House, a senior living facility in Maine, just outside of Portland, Maine, they have a preschool built right into the entrance to this senior living facility. And the most popular flats at Gorham House are the ones that overlook the playground. And, you know, it's just the soundtrack to Gorham House is the squeals and laughter of children as opposed to the humming of golf carts.
Yeah, the programs, though, that do aim to bring people together, like Experience Corps, you say is not as big as you had hoped. What keeps Experience Corps from getting bigger?
I feel like we haven't had that kind of ambitious national agenda that places like Singapore are putting together. And even the JFK, I talked about JFK's speech earlier. He had this plan of a national service corps of older people focused particularly on the well-being of the next generation that would be the equivalent of what the Peace Corps was aimed to be for young people. And it never quite got off the ground. And I think one of the things that's been missing is we need a Pied Piper. I spent time in England last year with Lucy Kellaway, a revered columnist for the Financial Times, who in her late 50s decided she wasn't going to write columns anymore but become a math teacher in a low-income London school. And she wrote a column to her readers announcing this shift at the age of 57, and she challenged them to quit their jobs, readers of a certain age, and join her in teaching math and science in these low-income schools. 1,000 people came forward to do that. They had originally 20 slots, so there were 50 applicants for every slot. They managed to ultimately raise that to 47 positions, but it created a national phenomenon like Teach for America became in the United States. And I think we need leaders like Lucy Kellaway to come forward and challenge those of us over 60, I'm 60 myself now, to think about the next generation and to tell us to, you know, focus less on trying to be young and rather to be there for those who actually are.
Right. I remember my grandmother telling me when she moved to West Palm Beach from Queens that it was like, my God, there are people on tricycles here. It's like they're having their second childhoods.
Yeah, the real fountain of youth is actually the fountain with youth.
Ah, that's a great way to put it and a great way to end it. Mark Friedman has been our guest this hour. His book is How to Live Forever, The Enduring Power of Connecting the Generations. Mark, it's been a blast. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Take it easy.
Talk to you, Jeffrey.
All right, take care.